Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason. No? Okay, I'm wrong again. Hi, Guy English. How are you?
I'm good. How's it going, pal?
Oh, it's going all right. Yeah, this is... it's weird hosting this without Jason, because as we just discovered in the section that will not be given to everybody else, I don't know how to make audio work right. This is a thing I do a lot, and yet... I don't know. Discord for me just makes it complicated enough that I don't know what's happening.
It feels like the kind of thing, once you set up once, it's don't change it, right?
Right, but it didn't even work the first time I did it. So that was the problem. Right. Like, and I had keep tweaking it from that point. And so now it's like, well, maybe this works, but I don't know. It's kind of a strange mess. So, yeah, this is not my strong suit. Honestly, Discord has a feature that we tried to use in the first place where it's like, just I would just invite you into Discord and then you would just... grab all, like, you would just be talking there, but like we ran into some problems with that too, so then we had to find a workaround, and now I think the workaround has overcomplicated. We never overcomplicate things with technology. That's not a thing we do.
Workarounds are just a way of life, and they completely and utterly complicate technology in every single way. Our society is predicated upon one workaround after the other.
This could very quickly devolve into a different type of podcast.
Well, it's like, I don't have the grain on me now. Can you take this little note that says I'll give you the grain in the future? And all of a sudden, now we've got bank fraud.
And grain fraud, which is even worse.
Bitcoin, yeah.
All right, well, there's some technology stuff we should probably talk about. Yeah, one of the things that was kind of interesting that I know you and I talked about maybe we should discuss was this security passcode thing. This was a story from Joanna Stern in the Wall Street Journal about a sort of spate of robberies in which people were being snooped on entering their passcodes into the devices, and then the devices would be stolen, and basically they would get locked out of their accounts, and in some really really terrible situations people would steal their money from their banking apps. I don't know what your take on this particular situation is. Do you feel like there is stuff that could be done to protect those things better, or is this just like, it's exactly what we're talking about, it's like it's a workaround, like it's a loophole?
I think all of those are true. It's been covered a lot on ATP and the talk show recently with Gruber, and everywhere. And it should be, because it's important. And definitely go check out Joanna's original reporting. And she has a co-author in the byline, and I'm going to blank on her name. Natasha something?
Yeah, I would have to look it up.
Could you go look that up?
Because I'll go
look
it up.
Probably, just, to be a good reporter kind of person. I think in some ways it is... it's like when they installed those little mirrors at ATMs in
right.
malls.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, shoulder surfing is bad. And when sort of debit cards or credit, like ATMs first came along, the notion that you would have like a 4 to 6 digit number and then somebody could take a bunch of your money was bad, and rightfully so. And we kind of got accustomed to that as a culture. The amount of damage you could do by getting into somebody's iCloud account, though, is quite significantly higher. In that, all your photos are there. Like, if you get mugged at the ATM, it's probably horrific. You lose, what, $200, whatever the max output is.
Right.
That sucks. Probably covered by insurance. Hopefully nobody gets hurt. And then, whatever. Bad interaction, but everybody goes on with their lives. This could be a lot more fundamentally destructive, in that like your memories and your personal photos could be lost, or at least locked up in iCloud so that they're effectively irretrievable, which is even more heartbreaking in a way. Like, they're just sealed in this cryptographic, unbreakable
box. Yeah,
box that you just can't get into, and you know that they are there and they exist, and it's impossible to touch them. That sucks. On the other hand, I'm not entirely sure what mitigating factors there could be, and I don't know what Apple could do better necessarily in the big broad sense. People are going to need to type 4 to 6 number codes into their phones. It's going to be very hard to break them of that. The biometrics effectively just unlock the secure enclave And the secure enclave is the one that actually has the keys to go and unlock your phone, the rest of the drive from your phone. So the issue is that basically the biometrics are a shortcut for your digital ID, your number. Which means as soon as you get that number and you manage to type it into a phone, you're kind of unlocked everything.
Right.
Gives you iCloud control, and then like...
It's kind of corollary to that thing where we were talking about... I mean, we were talking about this from a different perspective several years ago with essentially law enforcement access to your device and whether or not law enforcement can get access to your passcode. Because ultimately what interesting legal interpretation of that came down to was you couldn't compel somebody to give up their passcode, but you could use their biometrics, which is
right, which is awkward, funky, which is how
weird.
Yeah. And that falls out from the fallout from that may well be the fact that you can hold two buttons on your phone and get it into a mode where it will only ever accept the password so that the cops can't compel you to use your biometrics. Now, the thing is, I heard our pal John Gruber, the other one. we got a lot of Johns in our lives. Gruber was speculating that, like, he thought maybe, you know, take a photo of somebody, hold the two buttons down as you give it back to them. Then they're kind of, if they want to look at the phone, they need to type in the passcode. And that's when you shoulder surf them and try to figure out the code.
Right.
I think the purely numeric code... is real easy to learn how to, like, how many spy movies have we seen or you written where somebody can tell, like, it's just like an old school touch number pad and like,
smudges
it smudges or it's worn out in a certain way, or like if you watch that enough, a trained eye will be able to, there's only a certain number of combinations and just the way the hand moves and in a certain gesture you'll be able to figure out close enough with a reasonable degree of accuracy that if you swipe the phone, you'll be able to guess the thing within 10 attempts, right? Assuming you've practiced a little bit. I think that gets exponentially harder when you've got an actual alphanumeric passphrase in there. But
although the same idea, I remember there's a scene from one of my favorite movies of all time, Sneakers, where they are literally doing that, where they're like, they're filming somebody putting their passcode and they're stymied by the fact that somebody walks in front of the shot, essentially. Yeah. But, you know, people have been doing this for 30 years, which is, as long as we rely on passwords, somebody's going to be able to figure out what that is. And if that's all they need, you know, the corollary, I think, that was given over by Chris Finn, we talked about it a bit on Clockwise this week, was it's like somebody getting your house keys, right? Like, game over at that point. Like, if they got your keys, they can just let themselves in your house. Granted, they could break a window or whatever, too, but, like, this way is just making it easier, so...
Here's the thing, though. Nobody, and, like, unless they're in Ant-Man and the Wasp, nobody can just pick up your house and take off with it, right? Like, it can't happen. But somebody can swipe your phone. And so, like, the threat models are different. Like, breaking into a house is a real visceral thing.
Sure, right?
Like, you gotta either break a window or jimmy a lock. You're inside the house, which is definitely exposed to danger. I mean, justice slash whatever it is. You're in a situation that was going to get you caught red-handed. Grabbing a phone can happen real quick. It's pretty low stakes. You could probably pass it off. Like, who knows what's going to happen to you if you actually get caught. Probably just give the phone back and run away type thing. And yet, the potential damage is almost as high as if somebody broke into your actual home, right?
Yeah. I mean, and the trick here, I think, really is, and this is always the case, you talk to any, you know, person designing software that has any security component or security experts, whatever, and it's like, the trade-off is always security versus convenience, right? Like, you can make something super secure and require all these different levels of security, but the downside is if the user is getting frustrated because they have to enter six different levels of security every time, then it doesn't matter, because in the end, this is where people end up choosing, say, really terrible passwords, right? Like, because they're like, oh, it's just so inconvenient to type a super long string of passwords. So, you know, to go back to our conversation about workarounds, we ended up with things like password managers, where it's like, you can make your password really complicated, but then you still have to secure it with something, you know, that is, you can remember or is easier to remember. And at that point, you still have created, in some ways, centralized, you know, a security vulnerability, which is now they only need to figure out one thing that is, semi-easy to remember slash type in, and then they have access to everything. So that's the double-edged sword there, is like, it's really easy to use, but it also means that as soon as they have access to that thing, they have access to everything.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the mitigating factors could be don't allow you to change your iCloud password without typing the iCloud password in again. Although,
but if then you store it in iCloud keychain or something. Yeah,
exactly. Like, there's a bunch of... I'm sure everybody's working this out and they kind of came up with this. And I don't think that the outcome of this is completely surprising so much as it is... it's like stubbing your toe on something that you know is there. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, the end of the bed has like two little nubbins that come out on the side where you tuck stuff into, and I constantly crack my knee on that. I know it's there. I turn the corner a little too fast, and I hit it all the time. And I think it's one of those circumstances where knowing that you can get into the phone with just a password is kind of knowing. Like, we all know that, but what are the implications of that? What does that actually mean in terms of like the broad things that can happen? I think in Joanna's reporting, she mentioned bank account hacking. Mm-hmm. At least for my app, you need to do Face ID, and if that fails, it will fall back to asking you for the password for your bank account, not just simply your iPhone ID.
Right. And then the question is, do you have your bank account credentials in your keychain or not, right? Because then that can be accessed via the passcode. And
I guess so.
I definitely have some that do and some that don't, or at least... I have to check on this, but like the one that I think where it's just like a straight up password login, it may have like an optional PIN. The other one definitely has like a separate PIN. So like that is not stored anywhere, which is, you know, but it's also at the risk of compromising my own bank account. It's also only a 4-digit PIN, right? Where it's also like, well, you know, then you have only a certain number of combinations. How long does it take before you get locked out, et cetera?
Yeah. I mean, like you, I also have a 42-digit PIN.
Yes, correct. Yes.
Right. So I just wanted to catch you on that one. I'm not entirely sure how to address this, really. Like, what level of security would you expect? If you think it should just only move to the biometrics, well, like we just said, law enforcement can compel you to provide biometrics. Right. At least in the States. I don't know if that's been ruled on in Canada or elsewhere in the world.
And there's technological problems there too, right? I mean, anybody who lives in a cold climate can tell you that after a few months, your Touch ID, for example, doesn't work as well because your fingers get dried out and whatever, you need to retrain it. Biometric stuff, the face stuff too. Face ID is a little more, reliable, but there are also... It is possible to break it with false positives, right? Like, harder to do that manually, but like they even admitted that, like, on stage at times, it's like it can be misled or tricked in some way just by somebody, you know, false positive, somebody looking similar enough. And then you also need a way to fall back, because if something happens, you know, where God forbid you have, you know, a Touch ID and that finger is no longer available to you or something, or, you know, your face is changed in such a way that is no longer recognized, then, what do you do? How do you fall back to that?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, any biometric is basically just an encoded string of values, right? Like a longer one, but effectively, you know, it's going to do a match. And I think it is right, and it makes sense to use the passphrase, the PIN, as the canonical one source of, like, this is it. This is what actually gets you in. I'm wondering about, like, I don't think that can change necessarily. Like, I know Android phones do the same kind of thing, and it's kind of the way people expect their phones to work. What can change is, obviously it can't change, but I think what's more likely to change is the internal security structure around, like, what that means when you've actually unlocked your phone.
Right.
Currently, and I know it does not feel this way to anybody who uses iOS who's come from a more traditional desktop operating system background, but when you unlock your phone, it kind of in God mode a little bit, like you can go and do anything that user can do. You may need to log into a lot of services, which I think is very frustrating and gives people the notion that each service is kind of locked into its own thing. But once they're all in the keychain and everything gets made easier,
right?
you've effectively just handed over the keys to the keychain.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit on the Rebound this week as well, which is the issue. One issue becomes Apple's making this big push to pass keys, and that's great. It does improve security a lot, but a pass key is literally a thing you cannot remember, so it has to be in the keychain, at which point you have no alternative because it's not a thing that can, you know, you have to be able to sort of, I don't know, nuke that keychain remotely or something. Like, that feels like kind of like there needs to be a nuclear option where it's like, okay, my phone's been stolen. I can just shut it all down remotely in some way. But then that opens its own problems because then people can misuse that, right? Like, so, yeah, well, where's the balance?
I mean, even if you can't get into anything, if you manage to get into their mail settings and, like, add a forwarding rule.
Right, right. Or change the phone number or whatever, yeah.
Whatever it is, so that when they try to log into their thing and they inevitably have to do a remember, forgot my password thing, you get to see their email.
Right.
Or their code. Now you're laughing again. So, difficult. Very difficult. One thing I did think of is, like, well, if you... Maybe it needs to be in proximity to your watch, but that is a very hard sell, and I don't think a good solution. I think you could make it work in that, you know, you're out, you unlock your phone, somebody takes it and takes off, and they try to use it, and it's not, you know, within Bluetooth range or X number of meters from your watch, then require a special unlocking thing, like require both the code and a biometric or something.
Right, some sort of two-factor, essentially.
Effectively a two-factor thing, yeah. And the watch is like, as long as the watch is on your wrist, that feels like a decent proxy for you being there.
If you lose your watch, you know...
Your watch, and B, you shouldn't have to buy your watch to have your phone be secure.
Right, exactly.
Which is, I guarantee you, if they did roll that out, which they may, I don't know, that will be the knock on it in the press. It's like, Apple wants you to buy a $300 watch just to make your phone secure.
Like, feels like a jumped-up version of Elon charging more for security on Twitter.
Oh god,
charging more for worse security, whatever.
That guy would charge extra money for seatbelts if he could get away with it.
Well, actually, speaking, we won't spend too much time on that, but speaking of Twitter, the other big story that was going around this week was Tweetbot and Twitterific are both had updates in which they basically encouraged users to, if possible, if they felt comfortable doing so, decline or opt out of getting a refund. I mean, this basically comes up from third-party clients, obviously, were unceremoniously kicked off Twitter a couple months ago, and that is a big blow to companies like Tapbots and the Icon Factory, which rely on subscription revenue from them. So basically, essentially, people paid ahead for a certain amount of time, whether it be monthly or yearly, and in that case ended up with, you know, having paid for something and no longer having access to that service through no fault of Tapbots or the Icon Factory. We should be clear to say they were as screwed by this as the users, if not more so. So this is interesting because I think it gets into the heart of sort of the App Store and the way transactions work there. Because it's confusing and I think not well understood by the average user necessarily. I mean, I think developers obviously have to contend with this a lot. But, you know, I am just trying to sort of suss out, like, I saw somebody, I think it might have been Michael Tsai, writing about this and asking some questions about, like, well, how does this work in terms of, you know, who, like, does Apple claw back the money from your bank account, or does it end up as like a deduction from future sales? Why is this happening automatically in this case? Like, and I think it's unclear to me how much of this is stuff that, you know, Tapbots and the Icon Factory just maybe can't talk about for either legal reasons or negotiations with Apple reasons about this whole setup. So, I mean, I don't know. You've done some work in the App Store. Do you have any insight on refunds and how this, like, ends up hurting developers or affecting developers?
A little bit. But again, I'm friends with these guys, but I haven't spoken to them about this in particular. And I feel like if they had some sort of deal with Apple, they would not be allowed to discuss it. I guess... The notion is that you get your subscription, you get paid out by Apple. And now what's happening is that the remainder of the subscription that has not, that cannot be fulfilled, is going to need to be paid back to the subscriber, which means probably an 85-15 cut going back out of the bank account. So let's say it's $100 for a year, and it's been half a year in, you'll get $50 back. 15% of that $50 will come from Apple, and 85% will come from either the Icon Factory or Tapbots. That means that money is coming out of their bank accounts. Like, Apple needs that money in order to fulfill the... like, Apple's going to give the customer back the money, and then Apple's going to want that money from you. How that works, I don't know. And how that works in this, which may be a very special case, I don't think we will be privy to. Apple could be like, we're just going to waive it.
Right.
Like, just everybody shut up. This is not your fault. And we don't want to look like a bad guy here. So, but that's weird because now
right.
they've set a precedent, at least internally, that they're kind of willing to bail people out if they start selling subscriptions to a service that gets yanked. Like, what happens if I subscribe to, like, BitClown, the game where you throw bitcoins into a clown's mouth and then that service goes down and I'm on the hook for, like, thousands of dollars a year? What does Apple do? They can't internally make a rule, and they're probably loath to make up individual exceptions, you know, even... Hopefully not in this case. I think if you're going to do it for these guys. But
it seems like extraordinary circumstances. I mean, but sure, also yeah. the App Store has not been a place that has been, you know, lauded for being super cuddly for developers either. So I don't think Apple is in the business of saying like, don't worry, we'll cover you. We're good for it. You know,
No, but there is a kind of, and I'm sure people will feel two ways about this, but there's kind of a hilariously vindictive and fun App Store side to itself, which is, and I don't mean this in a good way, except that I sort of enjoy the schadenfreude of it, where when they were mad at Epic, they just started promoting, what was the other one? The other jumping around shooting game.
I don't even remember.
We're showing how old we are, man, because there's people screaming at this thing now.
Halo? Let's say Halo.
PUBG, PUBG sort of predated the thing. They're like, well, screw it. We're just going to push PUBG now. And I have to imagine that none of these people like Elon. I'm really quite convinced. So maybe they will just be like, yeah, screw it. We'll set up a deal where this can come out of your future payments or something. Who knows? I really hope that Apple doesn't let these developers sink, because they have... A, they're known to people inside Apple, for sure. Everybody knows who these people are. B, they've been such great platform citizens. They've really done their best to try to make the iPhone a success as much or as more as any other third-party independent developer. Like, they've done top-notch, amazing work since day one. Sometimes since before day one. Craig was doing jailbreak stuff. To sort of let some of their premier developers get sideswiped by... I'm trying not to make a self-driving joke here. To get sideswiped by Elon and his, you know, just chainsaw ballet is just not... It's not an auspicious sign for other developers on the platform, I would think.
Right. Yeah, no.
You know what I mean? Like, take care of
your own.
Even if you've got to bend the rules a little bit, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I see people talking about, I mean, I see me here in our chat room asks, is it fair to customers who have, say, let's say 6 months of service left? Fair. I mean, again, nobody is saying you can't get a refund. And if you have...
Oh, yeah. If you want to take about that.
Yeah, you take your money back. But we think what is often, I think, in this case being advocated is like, if everybody does that, it's like your classic, it's like Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life, right? Where it's like all the money's tied up in different people's houses. And if everybody takes, that's like a bank run, basically, right? If everybody decides I'm going to take my money back, then... Mm-hmm. that company will go under. That is just how it's going to work. And so nobody's, I think, suggesting that everybody should feel obligated to do it. But if you feel like you can spare it and you got your money's worth out of it, like I had, I think like a month left roughly or 3 weeks left or something on my subscription. And it's like, oh, you know, it's a couple bucks, whatever. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, I do want to make clear that I understand that perspective, and I'm not saying that there's any... effectively, at the end of the day, you paid for something, and it cannot be delivered to you.
Right.
That's it. That's all that matters to you. And I get that. It's not your fault, effectively. If anything, it's like the futures market. Like, I don't know. I'm sorry, man. I told you I was going to buy grain at this point.
Grain again. It's always the grain.
I know. Well, it's the most basic thing to understand, right? Whether it's trading money for it. But I'm going to buy grain at this price, and then I'm going to sell my bread at that price, kind of thing. And if the cost of grain goes all the way up, well, you can't necessarily change the bread subscription price. This is getting a little complicated. The notion that the upstream requirements for your product to work, those circumstances change, are not on the shoulders of the customers to bear.
Right.
You've made a deal with them, and if you can't honor that deal, bummer. Like, you're on the hook for it. That is 100%. That's business. That's the way it works. And
it's the way the cookie crumbles, some might say.
It's, yeah. from the grain that you harvested, yeah. The notion of this, though, is that... Just underscore that a little further. That is the default thing that will happen. Unless you take action and go and say you don't want to be refunded, Apple will refund you.
Right.
That is going to happen. Yeah. Like, take no action. What you think should be working in terms of the customers get what they paid for will work. That is the default. What's being said here is, look, if you feel good, like, basically it's a tip jar. Like, if you feel good that these people did their darndest to try to deliver you what you paid for, and with circumstances not inside their control, they can no longer do that. And in fact, circumstances are so not in their control that they may just fall off a cliff.
Right.
Well, it's, maybe give them a hand, because it sucks for you, but
whatever. Think this is where the fact that the community has largely rallied around these people goes to show. Let me rephrase that. The fact that so many people have advocated for it, I think, is because we are all well aware that even with that advocacy, only a small percentage will hear and act on that message. We're not going to, like, people posting about this on social media, or even me writing about it, and, you know, Federico and Gruber, everybody writing about it. Only a certain number of people are going to read that and think, oh, I should take the time to update an app or reinstall an app that I may have deleted, you know, open it up, decide to opt out of the refund, etc. So I think, you know, the long and short of it is, I'm guessing still their refunds will be the bulk, potentially, of their purchases. Yeah. So this is just a matter of helping defray that a little bit. If you feel like you said, like a tip jar, if you're in a position to be able to do it and just be like, hey, you know, it's like keep the change, right? Essentially. Like,
yeah. Effectively. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
So I paid
for a Big Mac and a side of fries, and I got like a little fry and a little Mac. I don't know. I've not been to McDonald's. I got four McNuggets. McDonald's is way behind me.
Let's use this. And let's put this in terms that you actually can understand. It's like you go to a Tim Hortons, and then
right, and I pay for a dozen Timbits, but I only get nine.
I have some questions.
Well, they had a run on Timbits.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. I mean, it's because of the grain, obviously.
Because of the grain, right? But what I'm saying is, one of the things I want to underscore is that if you are tired of hearing about this, that is because you are listening to Six Colors. You likely read Six Colors. You probably listen to ATP or Goober, or at least read some of their stuff. I don't know what the Venn diagram is, but if you feel like you've been inundated with calls to give up some of your money in order to support these independents, I promise you that's just because of the media environment you happen to swim in, and we've all been talking about it this week.
Yeah.
The vast, vast, vast majority of people will not hear this call to action, and then only some percentage of those who do will actually do anything about it, or in a position to do anything about it. And effectively, it's going to be a big bill at the end of the... whenever it is, whenever it comes to, however Apple collects it, for a couple of companies that I think have done stellar work and hopefully would like to keep around for a while. but it is not an admonishment. I don't think you're a bad person if you're not doing this. I get it.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So, anything else going on?
Oh man, yeah, big world out there.
it's been quite. February is not the most hopping month for Apple news. So,
no, I felt like there was a bunch of stuff though that we didn't talk about.
Oh, that's okay. We only have so much time.
Oh, I liked your super secret Apple org.
Oh,
piece. Yeah.
So many secrets. I just enjoy the idea that every time there is a secret organization within Apple, you know, it's just, no, that's not the real secret one. The real secret one is the super secret one. And of course, the secret ones are the ones we never hear about, right? Like the, you know, all right, the ones that we have heard about, obviously, how secret can they be?
Yeah. Remember when the SAS was secret? Or NSA?
No such agency.
Like, famously. I don't even know when that was published. Let's say the 90s.
It wasn't until the 80s?
Yeah. It feels like it was within our lives that, like, they admitted. They're like, yeah, we actually spy on radio stuff. Which,
I mean, there are people we know that used to work there that won't even admit to it.
There are, yeah. In fact, I know a guy who's at Apple now, but he used to be at Next. He's got a great story of selling old Next boxes to the NSA, and they met by driving two vans up on the side of the highway, sliding the doors open and moving the machines from one van to the other, and then taking payment.
Wow.
Which is insane. Yeah.
That is a thing. That is the way business used to be done before the internet, I guess.
Yeah. Like, at this point, there would have been a predator drone just flying over them being like, what the heck? And then, you know, some interagency spy movie would kick off. I feel like there's other stuff on the the docket.
There is, but that's okay. So we do a shortest show, so it's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. Well, all right. Okay. I'm gonna thank everybody out there for listening and for subscribing to Six Colors. We appreciate all your support. And of course, really are glad that you tune in for the podcast every week. And I am delighted that Guy was able to join me this week. We had it was nice to have both you and Micah on. I feel like it's nice to have different voices on at some points. And when I've been off, Jason's invited on different guests. So thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Really ground me down.
It was work.
Desperate for any more grain content.
All right. Thanks everybody out there for listening. And next week, Jason will be back and we'll resume our usually scheduled programming, at least for a couple weeks. And then I go on vacation. So somebody else will show up. We'll see how it goes. Until then, bye, Guy.
Bye, Dad.